Ethan Boland is one of Ireland's preeminent poets. She has made the lives of women central in her work.
This is dawn. Believe me, this is your season, little daughter. The moment daisies open. The hour mercurial rainwater makes a mirror for sparrows. It's time we drowned our sorrows. I tiptoe in. I lift you up, wriggling in your rosy, zipped sleeper. Yes, this is the hour for the early bird and me when finder is keeper.
Little by little, it seemed to me that that life that I was going to live, especially when small children were there, had every right to be considered as a visionary life the way many other human lives were. But that wasn't a name that I could find in the Irish poetry or the models I knew. It wasn't there. The idea that you would call this very routine life or this so-called domestic life visionary in any way and subject for poetry was simply not accepted. And people had all kinds of code words for that unacceptance.
Ethan Boland's anger at the way both she and her work were dismissed, undermined and even ridiculed still resonates 26 years after the publication of that poem, Night Feed.
The idea that a woman poet could change the tradition of Irish poetry was absolutely unfamiliar to people. And they regarded it as somewhere between, you know, impertinence and real disruption culturally. And the more I looked at that, the more I felt something was wrong. It certainly wasn't bravery. What it was a practical sense, which was that, you know, if I couldn't put the life I lived into the poem I wrote, then I didn't have any other choice except to write a poem that wasn't mine.
Boland, a formal poet, decided to put the life she lived, that of a wife and mother, into her poems. It was this act of bringing women's ordinary lives into poetry that so upset the literary establishment. Now in her 60s, she looks back with some frustration at the resistance to women poets in Ireland in the 80s.
There have been a lot of times in the past where a lot of ink, a lot of air was spent discussing personalities when we could have been talking about substantive issues in Irish poetry. And I make absolutely no apology for saying that because it's the literal truth. An awful lot of time was wasted on, you know, resisting something that was going to happen anyway. Women were going to write the Irish poem. Why on earth waste all that time saying the damage they would do? There's no damage whatsoever that I can see. And instead, there's been a very rich elaboration of a very strong poetic tradition. So what was all that about?
Geraldine Meany, Professor of English at UCD, sees Ethan's emergence as a breakthrough moment for women poets in Ireland.
What Boland did was not to bring the personal into poetry, but to take the feminist idea that the personal is political and to write a political poetry which was also personal. And I think that was a major step in terms of providing a self-conscious role of the woman poet within the national tradition. And Boland, unlike some of the younger generation, still does see herself as within a national tradition.
I mean, I can't think of a more significant cultural figure in the Republic of Ireland through the late 70s and early 80s than Ethan.
Poet and senior lecturer at Trinity College, Gerald Daw.
Her significance historically is that, one, she drew attention to the fact that to be an Irish woman and to be an Irish poet, that there was a problematical relationship between those two things. And also, and this is often overlooked, she was a very, very important figure in releasing some of the more complicated picture of what was happening in the north of Ireland.
Ethan Boland's father was a diplomat, which meant she spent a lot of her childhood abroad, mainly in England. Ethan's mother, the visual artist Frances Kelly, was a huge influence on her life. As a young student at Trinity College, Boland was longing to write good poetry. Brenda Kennelly was a supportive lecturer, and her contemporaries were poets Derek Mahan and Michael Longley. She recalls the struggle to find her own voice as a writer.
There is in every culture a distance, which can be a very mysterious distance between writing poems and being a poet. And how you cross that territory, how you go from writing poems to being a poet, is a very subtle, difficult internal process.
Can you remember a time when you thought, yes, I think I'm a poet, I am a poet now?
Well, I think there are bits and pieces of poems that you write when you're young where you seem to hear something that's really your own. And you lose it again, you know, you do. And there were some of those poems that I thought I heard myself in. Looking back now, you know, it's harder to see what that was. You spend a lot of your time, as a very young poet anyway, learning to write someone else's poem. You know, you spend a lot of your time learning a certain kind of craft, a certain kind of intense involvement. And I think it helps you later. I don't think it's wasted. But it's quite a distance from writing your own poem.
Her first collection, New Territory, in 1967, and The War Horse in 1975, marked her out as the gifted poet. But it was the tight, uncompromising verse of the next collection, In Her Own Image, in 1980, followed just 2 years later by Nightfeed, which set her apart and which defined her voice as a poet.
I crook the bottle, how you suckle, this is the best I can be. Housewife to this nursery where you hold on, dear life. A silt of milk, the last suck, and now your eyes are open, birth-coloured and offended. Earth wakes, you go back to sleep, the feed is ended. Worms turn, stars go in, even the moon is losing face. Poplars stilt for dawn, and we begin the long fall from grace. I tuck you in.
I was clear in my mind that if I wanted to live my life, which I did and which I believed in, it would have to be a part of the poem I wrote. If that involved a disruption, an engagement, an argument with what was there, well, then that was the way it would have to be. It also involved, at that time, isolation for me also, because there was very widespread resistance to it. And there was, eventually, I felt, a very emotive degree of attacks, which simply did not sit down and have the common sense to say, let's look at this argument and see if there's anything in it. Often the language used was so hysterically dismissive that I could not have written the poems that could have been so hysterically dismissed. And above all, the language didn't have that serious way of considering another viewpoint.
What had changed, what radicalized the young but more formal poet of New Territory was life. Boland married, moved to the suburbs, had two daughters, and began to see herself both as a poet and a woman connected to the lives of often invisible, silenced women, past and present. The ordinary became extraordinary.
By the time The War Horse came out, I was expecting my first daughter. Some big tectonic plate had shifted in my head by then. My ideas of who read a poem and who wrote a poem had really spun around, but it was going to take me time to process that. But the change had happened. It just wasn't visible, but it had happened.
In a way, Ivan opened the door. She identified through her own imaginative life emotional vibrations that hadn't really been released into the Irish mainstream. I mean, clearly they were there in America and to a less extent in England or the United Kingdom. But certainly here, there was a kind of tetchiness and an uncertainty about the relationship between being a woman and being a poet.
That change led to the groundbreaking collection In Her Own Image, where Boland, in an anti-lyrical style, addressed such unseen or invisible topics as anorexia, mastectomy, menstrual bleeding, and wrote from within a woman's body and what she called states of silence. The visceral mainstream reaction to the collection, where the poems were often rejected as neither art nor poetry because of their subject matter, pushed Boland out to the margins.
I felt that it was certainly open to argument, but very often it was emotive. I remember seeing a television program once where it came up for argument, and perfectly serious, clever people discussing it. And they simply did not have the composure to speak about it seriously. And I think that that ran up a sort of red flag for me about the level of serious conversation that we were all going to have. And in certain ways, I was justified because, you know, later that came to be a very important conversation.
They were very much politically charged about the position of the woman in contemporary society.
Gerald Dahl.
But they also burrowed inside into this inner landscape and explored women's sexuality in a quite, for Ireland, a very shocking way. So she was always ahead of the game. She was always very much part of a kind of cutting edge, critical breakthrough. I think in a way that that has sometimes it's eclipsed the poetry.
In Ireland, criticism has been very, very slow to follow the lead of the writers.
Geraldine Meany.
Because if you think of Boland's contemporaries, people like Adrian Rich, who were very influential for her, that breakthrough was being made in a lot of different places simultaneously. But in Ireland, the criticism was slower to catch up.
They felt that I was damaging the art and the Irish tradition, that part of it, with what they thought was a sociological viewpoint. My attitude to that was, look, 50%, if not more, of this country are women, and they live lives, and do we want those people not to have a voice? What have we got to lose by listening to that voice? What does it matter if it fails or succeeds? What matters is it's there. And did they really want to go back to their sisters, their daughters, their wives, their friends, other men, and say, we are such gatekeepers of the Irish poetic tradition that we better not let women write the Irish poem.
Publicly, how were you perceived then? Were you perceived, do you think, as a poet or more as a commentator, as a feminist?
Whether I was perceived as a poet, and this is truly not an overstatement, by the people who challenged it, could not at that point have mattered less to me. What mattered to me at that point was whether I thought what I was doing was solid. One thing was clear to me, that I was writing the political poem, and that I would have put In Her Own Image there, I would have put later work there. This was the Irish political poem, whether or not it garnered in external signals of the Irish situation. And so the likeness that I would make is really the idea of who writes the political poem in their time and who feels free to write it. Quarantine. In the worst hour of the worst season of the worst year of a whole people, a man set out from the workhouse with his wife. He was walking, they were both walking north. She was sick with famine fever and could not keep up. He lifted her and put her on his back. He walked like that, west and west and north, until at nightfall, under freezing stars, they arrived. In the morning, they were both found dead, of cold, of hunger, of the toxins of a whole history. But her feet were held against his breastbone. The last heat of his flesh was his last gift to her. Let no love poem ever come to this threshold. There is no place here for the inexact praise of the easy graces and sensuality of the body. There is only time for this merciless inventory. Their death together in the winter of 1847, also what they suffered, how they lived, and what there is between a man and woman, and in which darkness it can best be proved.
Boland's work in giving voice to the inner world of contemporary women led her to explore the silences or absences of women in history and their idolization in mythology. She wrote in Her Own Image that myths are made by men, and in subsequent collections like Outside History and In a Time of Violence, she began to rework the mythic past and give voice to the silenced.
You know, I began to think to myself there was a huge difference between the past and history in Ireland. that Irish history is a very eloquent and compelling story, but often a story of heroes. And the past is this formless territory of without boundaries or horizons, of whispers and losses and erasures. And it was the past that increasingly I began to feel very connected to, in its inventions, in its silences, in its fictions. And the belief that, you know, what you go to for history, which is a structured sense of meaning, was no longer meaningful to me or to a poet like myself. The only legend I have ever loved is the story of a daughter lost in hell and found and rescued there. Love and blackmail are the gist of it. Ceres and Persephone the names. And the best thing about the legend is I can enter it anywhere and have.
I think your poem, The Pomegranate, is a great example of the way you merge myth and personal experience, and that easiness you feel of floating from personal experience into myth.
There are some myths, there are these big sleeping diagrams, you know, of human experience, and when you take them out again and you put them into a moment, they do very well. You know, my daughter Sarah, who really is the subject of the poem, was about 14 at the time, and she would study, and then, you know, she might have a book and she might fall asleep there. She'd have a can of Coke beside her, and so when I came up the stairs, it's what I would see. She would be there. And what I really was thinking wasn't about the myth. I was thinking, how will I get a can of Coke into that poem? That was the real thought. It is winter and the stars are hidden. I climb the stairs and stand where I can see my child asleep beside her teen magazines, her can of Coke, her plate of uncut fruit, the pomegranate. How did I forget it? She could have come home and been safe and ended the story and all our heartbroken searching, but she reached out a hand and plucked a pomegranate. She put out her hand and pulled down the French sound for apple and the noise of stone and the proof that even in the place of death, at the heart of legend, in the midst of rocks full of unshed tears, ready to be diamonds by the time the story was told, a child can be hungry.
In poems like Lava Cameo, The Parcel, and The Fan My Mother Gave Me, Ivan uses objects as fossils of memory.
I've always been interested in the nature poem, which I could never have written. But, you know, in a certain way, I have wanted to be, in some ways, I might be, an indoor nature poet. The things that are indoors are so often small, hidden histories. They can't speak and they can't tell their story. They're these mute witnesses to what happened. And a lot of the poems I have written have been interested in that. These things that accompany our lives that we held and we picked up and we used and we had, and they vanish. But they can't, they've witnessed it, but they can't speak about it. And that in itself is some strange testament about language. And it's almost like a sort of bestiary of silences. And it's somehow something I've come back to often.
Is it true that you have no time for 19th century ideas of poetic inspiration?
The idea of inspiration comes from the Romantic movement in the 19th century, when people like Shelley were writing, you know, very ardent Neoplatonic things like The Defense of Poetry. No other art, no musician, no painter has that idea. You know, a painter, I was a painter's child. Painter gets up in the morning and they wait to see, is the light good enough to paint? They don't wait to see if they're inspired. It's always seemed to me something that puts poetry on a very exempt basis. And, you know, I've always disapproved of it.
Even from the very beginning, did you wait to be inspired?
No, I'd be still waiting. You know, I wrote. I didn't way to be inspired. There isn't anything that's going to inspire you. It's just your own writing, the mistakes you make and the mistakes you correct, that's going to produce what you're doing. I mean, that idea of process and product is different for a lot of people. For me, the process leads to the product.
Since 1996, Yvan Boland has been Professor of Humanities and Director of the Creative Writing Programme at Stanford University in California. It's given her distance from Ireland, freedom from some of the claustrophobic debate about her work, and the ability to flourish creatively with new collections like Domestic Violence.
It's really a wonderful university. It has a lot of different things that go on, but above all, it gave me the chance to teach young poets. It gave me the chance to continue the conversation elsewhere. And I am increasingly of the view, you know, that it's now in poetry because of travel and publishing and the widening of our world in that way. It's one conversation now. It's all one conversation. We don't have to ignore any part of it. I don't have to ignore anything Irish to be out there. But I can put things together in my mind in a certain way about poetry out there and bring it back here. And it hasn't been a bad thing that I've been away from some of the personalizations here, which I felt at times distracted from the conversation about poetry.
In Boland's case, she was always an internal exile. In a way, Boland has a much more secure place now in terms of how Irish writing is defined now that she lives outside of Ireland. So it's almost as if, having left Ireland, she has become an insider in the tradition. And that moment where Bertie Ahern quoted her in his speech to the Congress in the United States is a moment which marks how mainstream, how much part of the national tradition she has now become.
In the words of the poet Yvan Boland, that eloquent voice of America and Ireland, they had their hardships parceled in them, patience, fortitude, long-suffering in the bruised-coloured dusk of the new world, and all of the old songs and nothing to lose.
It was a great honour, and I was very moved and very appreciative, and I also thought it was a wonderful speech. And one of the things that I think was also moving, you know, I spent 3 years in the United States as a child at 12, and we aren't immigrants anymore.
The significance of this poem, quoted by Bertie Ahern, is for Yvan not just a reminder of our past, but a warning about the dangers of what we might lose in our affluence.
Like oil lamps, we put them out the back of our houses, of our minds. We had lights better than, newer than, and then a time came, this time, and now we need them. Their dread makeshift example. They would have thrived on our necessities. What they survived, we could not even live. By their lights now, it is time to imagine how they stood there, what they stood with, that their possessions may become our power. Cardboard, iron, their hardships parceled in them. Patience, fortitude, long suffering in the bruise-colored dusk of the new world, and all the old songs, and nothing to lose.
Given that your aim was to put women and the subject of women central in poetry, are you happy that you've achieved what you set out to do?
I wouldn't have been able to put women anywhere if I wrote bad poems. I mean, my aim has been to write good poems. I mean, that has been, in a sense, the one coherent thing since I've been 18. I really longed to write good poems. I've been a poet in some of the old-fashioned way, you know. I only think in terms of a number of poems that worked and a number of poems that didn't. And the poems that worked, I'm glad about. And the poems that didn't, I feel very frustrated about, even to this moment. And that frustration, I think, is quite a big part of my life. I wish I had been able to do things more nimbly, more ably, because I thought I could do certain things, and you look back into every single book and something that you thought you could do, you didn't do. But the thing that has really mattered is to try to write the poem that you look at and think, well, that worked out.
I know that for writers, the main consideration is the writing. They are writers before they are Irish writers, before they are women writers. And I think that one of the greatest disservices that has been done to poets like Boland is that they have become representative of so much. And that in a way you have to learn to put the poet aside and read the poetry. She's not an obscure poet, but there is a wedding of complexity of form and complexity of subject in the last three volumes, I would say, of her work, which is really stunning, and it is the work of a mature poet at the height of her powers.
In some ways, you always write the same poem. I mean, in a certain way, you write it and you argue about it. We're inclined to look at a poet and say, look at that poet. They're going to be 20, and we'll expect that by the time they're 70, they will have continually grown into this, you know, great figure. That isn't the way the poetry has ever worked. If you go back, you will see the poets write poems when they're 30 that they could never write when they're 50, and they write poems at 50 they could never write when they were 30. Poetry is very well set up to capture the energies of different seasons in people's lives. And what you want to do is have the ability to write the poem for the season that you're in. I could warn her, there is still a chance. The rain is cold, the road is flint-colored, the suburb has cars and cable television, the veiled stars are above ground. It is another world. But what else can a mother give her daughter but such beautiful rifts in time? If I defer the grief, I will diminish the gift. The legend will be hers as well as mine. She will enter it as I have. She will wake up. She will hold the papery, flushed skin in her hand, and to her lips, I will say nothing.
That program on Ivan Boland was presented by Kay Sheehy and was taken from a series of six programs on women writers called Women and Words, which was first broadcast on RTE Lyric FM in 2008. It was produced by Helen Shaw and was an Athena Media production supported by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland's Sound and Vision funding scheme from the television licence fee.